Immigration reform looks like it will be passed in the Senate, likely by the end of the week. Among other things, the bill will allow companies to import a lot more skilled workers. The tech industry has lobbied hard for this, despite concerns that it will mean extra competition for American workers. To that fear, Illinois Senator Dick Durbin insists the bill has American workers covered.
Employers will be given a chance to hire a temporary foreign worker when truly needed. But first, they'll be required to recruit Americans. No exceptions, no excuses.
Still, as NPR's Martin Costi reports, making companies recruit Americans isn't the same as making them hire them.
If you talk to disgruntled tech workers much, sooner or later, one of them is going to send you this video.
And our goal is clearly not to find a qualified and interested U.S. worker.
That's an immigration lawyer from Pittsburgh in what looks like a seminar for clients a few years ago. In this video, he's telling the clients what to do when they want to sponsor one of their foreign workers for a permanent visa, a green card. The problem is the government. It makes them prove that they looked for American workers first. So they have to advertise the job. But he tells them they don't have to advertise it too conspicuously.
Certainly, we are not going to try to find the place where the applicants are going to be the most numerous. We're going to try to find a place where, again, we're complying with the law and hoping and likely not to find qualified and interested worker applicants.
Immigration law firms do this all the time. They show employers how to recruit Americans without actually having to hire them. This lawyer didn't want to talk to NPR, maybe because the anti-visa activists have been sending this video around for years. It's Exhibit A in their argument that the recruiting rules are a sham. And in techie parts of the country, this kind of faux recruiting is common knowledge.
A lot of us are aware of that ruse.
A software tester named Orion Hughes is sitting in a coffee shop in Redmond, Washington. He says people in his industry quickly learn not to waste their time on certain job listings, especially the listings with overly specific requirements, say X number of years in, quote, the job offered. That often means that they just want to make permanent a temporary foreign worker who's already in the job. And if you're stubborn enough to apply anyway, he says that interview is going to be awkward.
If you want to put yourself in that manager's shoes, it's an uncomfortable situation for them. There will be kind of a sour facial expression, and they'll go from one question to the next. They are finding some reason to exclude you.
Employers usually go through these motions only when they're sponsoring a foreigner for a permanent visa. But now the Senate immigration bill would extend somewhat similar requirements to temp workers, the foreigners on the so-called H-1B visas that have become so common and so controversial in the lower-end tech jobs. The bill would have the employers post those jobs online first, and there'd be more recruiting rules for companies that use H-1Bs a lot. It sounds good, but it's a move that seems to ignore all the ill will that's been generated over the years by the insincere recruiting.
No one is ever hired.
Bruce Morrison is a former congressman who helped to design the current work visa system. Now he's an immigration lawyer and a lobbyist. He says the recruiting rule in the green card system came with a fundamental flaw.
Which is it doesn't start until you've already picked the person you want. The decision whether to hire an American already happened, and you didn't.
He's one of the many experts who've given up on these recruiting rules. He says the better fix would be for the government just to charge employers a heftier fee.
Create the economic circumstance where it costs you a lot more to hire a foreigner. And you'll only do it if you can't find an American who's suitable.
The Senate bill takes some small steps in this direction, but Morrison thinks it's not nearly enough. The bill actually removes the recruiting rule for some of the permanent visas, and he's happy about that. He's been lobbying for a while to get more green cards into the hands of skilled workers. But now it looks like the Recruit Americans First idea is being shifted to the temporary visas, the H-1Bs. And that means the tech industry will still be plagued by insincere job listings and bogus interviews, and the undercurrent of resentment that those create. Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.
And in other news, prices for a single-family homes in major U.S. cities jumped more than 12% over the past year, according to the latest Case-Shiller Home Price Index. That was more than economists had been expecting and made a lot of people happy, especially in Las Vegas. Prices there have jumped over 20% over the last 12 months, and that's in a city that used to be known as America's foreclosure capital. NPR's Nathan Rott traveled to Vegas to find out what's going on.
Lisa DeSosa is sitting in her air-conditioned office in West Las Vegas, going through a list of phone numbers.
I do three rings and on to the next one.
She's cold-calling homes in Sun City, a suburb that's just a few manicured miles of cookie-cutter suburbia to the north, because, oh, she's got one. This'll explain it.
Hi, good morning. My name is Lisa. I'm a local realtor, and I was calling today because many homeowners are taking advantage of our improved market, and I was just wondering if you had given any thought to selling your home at this time.
The Las Vegas housing market is so tight right now that realtors are calling people to try to get them to sell their homes, with varied results.
Hello? She hung up.
Realtors are always trying to find homes to sell, but right now in Vegas, it's taken on a new fervor.
Right now, on average, an average listing we have, we could say there's no less than 15 offers on a property that we have.
That's Noah Herrera. He's vice president of the Las Vegas Association of Realtors. And he says a normal, healthy housing supply has enough homes to meet a six-month demand. Right now, Vegas has barely enough for 5 weeks. One reason, he says, is an influx of big-money investors, Wall Street and hedge funds, who are buying up properties in bulk.
We have institutional investors that are coming in and taking all of our inventory, overbidding, paying cash.
Another big reason, Herrera says, is
federal laws, local laws. There was a law that was passed in 2011, which was AB 284.
Now, Assembly Bill 284 did locally what other federal laws did nationally after the housing market crash. It made it harder for banks to foreclose. And it did that by making mortgage and foreclosure practices more transparent. It also ended things like robocalling and predatory lending.
Well, it's a bill that's meant to protect homeowners.
Luis Lopez is an analyst at the Lead Institute of Real Estate Studies in Las Vegas.
To me, it makes sense that banks have to show the homeowner that they have the authority to foreclose. It just seems something very basic.
And many local realtors say it worked, slowing down foreclosures. Just look at the numbers. In September of 2011, there were 4,000 notices of default in the state of Nevada. In October, after the bill was passed, there were 80. And here's the thing. Fewer homes in foreclosure means fewer homes being pushed to the market. And the result is economics 101. Limited supply plus high demand equals, you guessed it, higher prices. But that may not be a bad thing. Again, our realtor, Noah Herrera.
Because the values have gone up so much, it's now causing normal people that were underwater to be able to sell their houses.
And the number of people who are underwater in Nevada, or who owe more on their house than it's currently worth, is a lot. In 2010, it was 70% of mortgage owners in the state. Today, it's less than 50. Clara Padilla-Silver is part of that statistic. According to an appraisal, she was underwater $35,000 on her Las Vegas home.
And we didn't qualify for any kind of a modification.
Her only option, she thought, was to do a short sale, to sell the house for less than it's worth, even if it damaged her credit. That's what her neighbor was doing. But then Silver thought,
the craziness is escalating in Las Vegas, so I said, let's take a chance. We'll list it for a couple of weeks.
And wham.
We got a cash offer for $233,000, and that's, what, $50,000, something like that, over what I thought the house was valued at.
That deal fell through, but a week later she got a similar offer, one that she expects to close in the next few weeks. But it better happen fast for the buyers, she says, because when she checks online real estate databases,
the value of my house increases about $1,000 every 2 days.
That, she says, is the craziness of Vegas. Nathan Rott, NPR News.
Most of us are still thinking about our summer vacations, but Frank DeFord, our sports commentator, is already looking ahead to fall and college sports. What he's thinking about this morning, too often sports and college don't add up.
We usually think of college sports in terms of classic big-time schools, polls, and bowls. But in fact, our athletics are intertwined with and complicate all higher education. The University of North Carolina, Wilmington, provides a typical recent case. The Seahawks field teams in 19 Division I sports, but unfortunately, like many colleges, UNCW athletics are in the red. So the chancellor, Gary L. Miller, assembled a committee which recommended the elimination of five sports: men's and women's swimming, men's cross country, and indoor track and softball. Well, that produced a firestorm, especially with swimming, which has won the conference 12 years in a row and which financially is about on budget. Now, by contrast, the basketball team has a deficit of $1 million. The coach himself earns almost $500,000 a season, notwithstanding that the team lost two-thirds of its games and is academically on probation. So, why not just get rid of big basketball? Well, fans don't show up to see cross-country or swimming, do they? Isn't part of the power and charm of college sports that it brings town and gown together cheering our school on? Isn't that the American way from high school right on up? Like a lot of his colleagues, Chancellor Miller also has to factor in the reality that his school is tilting female. 60% of UNCW students are women, and the majority grows. And Title IX requires athletic percentage to reflect gender proportion. Chancellor Miller is also being whipsawed to upgrade facilities so the Seahawks can be competitive with their rivals. UNCW is in the Colonial Athletic Association. No, it's not the Big Ten. But the CAA stretches about 1,100 miles, and every college is desperate to get into a better conference, maybe even get on ESPN. So, what did Chancellor Miller, a biologist by discipline, do? Well, obviously influenced by the thousands who signed petitions, he decreed that he was keeping all sports. But he offered a provocative afterthought. He suggested that those folks so blithe about signing sports petitions might leverage their passion, which is apparently what a polite biologist says when he means put your money where your mouth is. We in the U.S. think nostalgically of athletics as integral to higher education, but perhaps sports simply should be entirely separated from the academic and turned into an honest commercial adjunct. Leverage, indeed. Let alumni and local businesses pay for sports. Certainly would make a lot of college presidents happier. And passionate alumni could then sign petitions to keep courses like medieval history and Western philosophy. Yeah, sure.
Commentator Frank DeFord joins us each Wednesday. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green.
Let's go to China, where professional mourners have been communicating sadness at funerals for centuries. They were banned for a time by the communists during the upheaval of the Cultural Revolution. So when NPR's Beijing correspondent Louisa Lim read about one of China's most famous professional mourners, she thought it would make an interesting story about the reemergence of traditional practices. She was in for a surprise. Here's her postcard from a modern funeral with Chinese characteristics.
This is the sound of a funeral in China. I'm on the outskirts of the city of Chongqing, and I'm about to meet someone whose job is to go to funerals.
Jingjing Mao is famous for her performance at funerals, her weeping and wailing, and her hair, which she wears in two high bunches. Our entry into this world is splendidly dramatic, she says, so our exit from this world also needs to be spectacular. She's here to represent the children of the deceased. Her crying shows their piety. In the background, a man in red and yellow robes is burning paper money while musicians play traditional instruments. At first, I take him to be a monk, but it turns out he's an actor, but not one of Jingjing Mao's troupe of seven.
So, as normal, they're cooking a big meal for the whole community, and they've set up a tent and they're cooking it outside. But at the same time, it's happening really in the backyard of a housing complex. There are all these six-story blocks of apartments beside me, and I can see skyscrapers going up just down the road. It's really transplanting old traditions right into modern China.
We need a proper mourner because young people don't know how to cry anymore, explains Xu Xinwei. It's her uncle's funeral.
As with everything else in China, the funeral starts with food. And there's a big communal meal out here. There's about 10 tables. Each of them have got about 10 dishes on them each, and they all look really spicy, and it looks incredibly good.
Zhang Yingshu is the daughter of the dead man, Zhang Tujin. He was 67 years old and died of heart failure. He was a farmer who worked hard his whole life, she says, even hauling sacks of potatoes the day before he died. We need to give him a proper send-off, she says, wiping away her tears as she tucks into her food.
So the funeral is about to begin, and everybody is pulled up green plastic stools and is sitting there really expectantly waiting. The mood is kind of like the mood before a big blockbuster film is about to start.
To the strains of the Antanasional, Zhang Tujin's family walks forward to stand around his coffin. On their heads, they wear white sackcloth, the colour of mourning in China. Ding Ding Mao begins the eulogy. She's dressed in white satin. Her face is serious despite her incongruous ponytails bouncing above her ears. He was a good man, she says. A good husband, a good father, a good grandfather. He has gone now. He has left this world full of love. Ding Ding Mao is now on her hands and knees, crawling towards the coffin, coloured lights flashing above her. You were like a tall tree sheltering your kids from the wind and rain, she moans, lying face down on the floor. We never thought you'd leave so soon. People are weeping all around me now. And then suddenly, it's over, and a young woman from the troupe is belly dancing in front of the coffin. The mood is utterly transformed. People are wiping away their tears and smiling. It feels kind of like sunshine after a storm.
Well, I have never been to a funeral like this before. There's strobe lighting, there's karaoke eulogies, there's belly dancing. But you know what? The crowd is loving it. There's a huge stream of people that are coming to attend the funeral. And the family is feeling that their loved one is being remembered in the right way. And that's what counts. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Chongqing.
The sounds of professional mourners, only on Morning Edition from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Communication between people who speak different languages is an age-old challenge. Today, computer programs can translate words instantly, but what about conversations that need translation? Intense conversations where life or death could hang in the balance. Well, police, paramedics, and other first responders increasingly encounter that kind of situation. And as Minnesota Public Radio's Conrad Wilson reports, there is new technology aimed at instantly bridging the language gap.
A paramedic arrives at this scene. A screaming baby is badly burned, but the mother doesn't speak English, and the medical staff can't communicate with her.
Good evening. Hi, I have a lady that speaks Arabic. We need to get some information on her baby. Okay. Ask her what exactly happened. What was the baby burned with?
It turns out the baby was burned in a cooking accident.
Okay, just let her know that I have a doctor that's with us right now. The gentleman in the gray shirt is a doctor, and we're going to be transporting her and the baby to Children's Hospital. Let her know that.
Okay.
That conversation was possible because of a device called ELSA, Enabling Language Service Anywhere. Using a cell phone signal, the handheld device gives users access to interpreters in about a minute who can translate between English and 180 other languages. The interpreters themselves work for a company called LanguageLine Solutions, but the ELSA device is made by a Minnesota-based company created by this guy.
I'm Charles Howerton, the founder
and VP of New Business Development for RTT Mobile.
Howerton came up with the idea 6 years ago after he struggled to communicate with Spanish-speaking workers at his construction company.
I was able to build my first prototype, and it had wires hanging out of it and a radio board hanging out of it. Pretty rough looking, but it actually worked very well.
Since then, the device has become more sophisticated. Roughly the size of an old school cell phone, it has 3 buttons, built-in microphones, and a speaker.
Calling one.
Pushing a button once brings up a Spanish translator.
Thank you for calling RTT Mobile Interpretation. Please hold while I get connected with your Spanish interpreter.
About 30 seconds later, the interpreter is ready to translate from English to Spanish and from Spanish back to English.
Hi, this is Francine. I'll be your Spanish interpreter. How can I help you?
The ELSA translation tool was released in December. Howerton says it's already in use around the country.
First responders, medical, police, fire, they're the ones that need to communicate the most.
Law enforcement officers in St. Cloud, Minnesota recently started using the ELSA translation device. Sergeant Jason Burke works in the training unit at the St. Cloud Police Department and says he relied on bilingual officers and other translation services that require scheduling an appointment.
The difference is the immediacy of getting access to an interpreter.
Burke says the new device fills that need. He says it was recently used when police and paramedics needed to deliver a baby, as well as during a domestic violence call.
As years go on, in whatever community that you're in, you can see a lot more non-English speaking people moving into the community. It has been difficult in the past to be able to communicate with some people when you have contact with them through law enforcement.
Burke says the main drawback is cost. The department has just a few for its entire patrol unit, and at $400 apiece and up to $2 per minute to operate, a complicated police call can quickly become expensive. Still, it appears those costs aren't slowing down business. According to the company, use of the ELSA device is growing, some months doubling in use. Now Howerton says RTT Mobile is preparing to bring the device to the general public through a Kickstarter project this summer. Howerton says the funds will help pay for the next generation of the device that will make translation easier for everyone, not just first responders.
Like me, like I ran into on the construction site, you know, many times I wasn't able to communicate with people that I needed to. It was just a lot of grief and headache and very time-consuming.
This part of the technology industry is full of innovation. Last year, Microsoft unveiled a vocal translation program, but by the company's own admission, there are still errors. Not something you want in a first responder situation. For NPR News, I'm Conrad Wilson.
Okay, we're about to solve a mystery at an organization that got its start back in 1888. That was during the women's suffrage movement with leaders like Susan B. Anthony. The National Council of Women of the United States still exists today in a small office near the United Nations in New York City. On the organization's 125th anniversary, people there cracked into a time capsule of sorts, an old safe painted with the words Women's Suffrage Party. No one knew what was in the safe or when it had last been opened. NPR's Margo Adler takes us there.
On the website of the University of Rochester's Susan B. Anthony Center, people have been speculating all week about what might be in the safe. Will we find lists of secret members, asked one person, organizing strategies and protest plans? Perhaps the original copy of the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote? Perhaps love letters? Perhaps photographs? Perhaps nothing, someone else said. And that's exactly what the safe cracker, Elad Israeli, said. Most times when he opens safes, there's not much.
You know, rubber bands, paper clips, pens.
Israeli started to work the combination lock while people crowded into a tiny room.
I don't want to sound rude, but I really need quiet to be able to concentrate.
He said it would take anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour as he manipulated the combination lock back and forth, occasionally making notes on a pad, and then suddenly it was done.
I can open it now.
Just pull on the handle.
Pull on the handle.
Oh, there's some stuff in it.
And there is stuff in there. A lot of stuff.
A lot of stuff in here.
First, there was a change purse filled with coins from France, Mexico, various countries. There was a box with a Smithsonian replica of the gavel originally used by Susan B. Anthony and an envelope that revealed the safe had been opened within the last 14 years. I said to Catherine Cerulli, the director of the Susan B. Anthony Center at the University of Rochester, some of this stuff is modern.
Yes, and I think, in fact, when you look at the stamp on that envelope, it's 1999.
Yeah.
So someone got in.
Someone's been in.
There were medals, a silver brooch, a wooden stamp, a corporate seal, a paper of incorporation dating back to 1931, and many other documents.
Federal tax exemption, it looks like 1957. IRS letter, 1940.
They didn't open the documents and letters because archivists suggested they handle them with care, and many may later be digitized. Perhaps the most lovely items were six small panels, replicas of huge wall murals of women that were commissioned for the Chicago World's Fair in 1933. We look at one of the panels. Catherine Cerulli points out that one woman is clearly a Red Cross worker.
Historical pictures of women, women caring for others. Perhaps these are historical figures.
Why was the safe not open for a long time? Mary Singletary, the president of the National Council of Women of the United States, said the hundreds of dollars needed to hire a locksmith was just too much for an organization struggling to survive with multiple projects about women and girls.
I had to make a choice of raising money for my program or raising money to pay this gentleman.
She chose the programs until the University of Rochester joined the effort. One thing they found was a candy box filled with keys, one going to a storage room in the basement. So who knows? There may be more discoveries. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.